You're listening to the Pre-Hospital Care Podcast on the Medics Academy Network.
Welcome back to the Pre-Hospital Care Podcast with myself, Owen Walker. In this episode, we're looking at global health system strengthening with Anisa Persab. So what we're to do in the conversation is examine how to approach systems strengthening in clinical practice within the context of Sierra Leone. So we're going to look at Anisa's recent deployment to support continued professional development at local, regional and national level, and her role in leadership development whilst in post in Sierra Leone. We're going to examine how she disseminated education and training, policy and governance, and how she approached cultural change from the ground up. Finally, we're going to examine how she built and maintained safe systems of practice and how you can embody a culture of educational leadership and empower co-produced solutions to provide systems development work. So to do this, we have Anisa with us. Anisa's recently held a post of Nursing Education Advisor to the Chief Nursing and Midwifery in Freetown, Sierra Leone. She collaborates across NGOs to work with Sierra Leone Ministry of Health and Sanitation to standardise nursing education and support national strategic delivery. She's been a senior nurse both inside and outside of the UK NHS, working for Health Education England as a clinical lead and clinical advisor supporting education and workforce development across London. Anisa is an emergency nurse by trade and has experience leading central London emergency departments before going on to wider systems leadership roles. Welcome to the podcast, Anisa.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me.
This is slightly different. We're actually doing a podcast in person, which is quite nice, actually, post-pandemic. But Anisa, could I just start by asking you around how you acquired a role, number one, in development from nursing, and number two, in Sierra Leone, and what your mandate was?
And it's a question I kind of get asked a lot around how to get into global health work. So I started to do some work with an NGO during COVID, looking at ICPC support in response to the COVID pandemic. So I was doing that work remotely in the UK with DRC and Somaliland. So these are short-term projects. So I stayed in touch with the NGO, I joined up to their newsletters, and really just kept conversations going. A few months later on, a longer post came up in Sierra Leone, which was for a year, and it was around looking at systems development and supporting CPD in the main referral hospital in Freetown, which is the capital of Sierra Leone. It was a three-year project, and I was going over to sort of hand the project over to the national staff. So there were two previous volunteers that had gone out before me, and I was doing the last leg of the relay. So we were looking at education systems and continuing to sort of teach things like vital signs and basically sew together all the different teaching programs that the NGO had already worked on and kind of building that CPD framework. What I ended up doing was something slightly different, as it always is with these things. What I progressed to doing was working with the Chief Nurse and Midwifery Officer as the Education Advisor in the Ministry.
So that really is a fundamental shift in your appointment. But just looking at just how that played out. So if you could, I guess, speak to some of the fundamental challenges that you found on appointment, and just maybe how you mitigated some of those challenges just from the ground up, really.
Shall I give a bit of context about Sierra Leone to start off with? So it's not a very big country. It's got about 9 million. The population is about 9 million. They had a 10-year civil war. They had Ebola. There are some difficulties with the actual, you know, the infrastructure of their country, you know, and they have things like landslides and gas explosions and fires that happen. So in terms of where it sits, you know, it is a developing country that has got a lot of NGOs present there. And I think when you're working in some of these countries, it can feel a little bit like there's a revolving door of NGO workers. There's lots of duplication. There's lots of people kind of doing things, you know, the American way, the German way, the UK way. So one of the fundamental challenges was around sort of like mitigating what my role was and how that slotted in to the system I was working in, but also the other people trying to do similar things. So, I mean, you were in Sierra Leone as well for some time. I don't know if you found the same similar kind of challenges.
Yeah, absolutely, Anissa. So a part of the challenge, I was working with Tony Blair Foundation or Institute for a while, and the coordination piece was big. So it wasn't that you're not disparate, you are coordinated, you are actually servicing a need which has been need assessed. So there's some global need assessment, or indeed sort of local need assessment, and that you actually are fulfilling a need on the ground. In our case, it was a training need, but that is then disseminated and communicated up, so that someone else isn't doing exactly the same training at the same time. But so I very much found that on the ground there was some coordination, but there was also a lot of disparate working on the ground as well. Was that your experience?
Yeah. So I think, and you know, you were talking about doing some work with training and education, and I think there is something around education fatigue that happens. So there's so many people that think the answer to everything is training and education, but unless we tailor that training and education to what the system actually needs, we're just retraining people to do the same thing in a slightly different way. And if somebody retrained me how to check vital signs 50 different times over, you know, 5 or 6 years, I'm going to get tired of it as well. So I think, you know, one of the key things, you know, we're talking about ways to sort of mitigate that, going into the organisation and going into any new organisation, is kind of checking the pulse. And this is something that I do in other roles as well, whether that's in the NHS, working on a new ward, or doing system strengthening work. It's something about checking the pulse of the organisation. So, like, you know, I'm an A&E nurse through and through. So when, you know, my ways of approaching things, you wouldn't just go up to a patient and start delivering treatment without taking a history, without doing your own assessment. And when you're doing systems change and systems management and change management, you need to do the same thing. So it's sort of the same process of look, listen, and feel. You do it with your patients, and you should do it with the organisation. So there was something around, first, when you're going into a new system, just standing still, seeing what it is like, actually being part of it. So I did a load of clinical shifts when I first got there because I wanted to understand what it was like to work in the departments in Sierra Leone. I did audits to kind of get some, you know, data to see, okay, what is the data showing me? How does that match up with what I'm feeling on the ground when I'm doing the work? And I asked a lot of questions. And I think there's a piece of the wider systems work. So it's looking at all the moving parts and how they interact with each other. So one of the projects I was working on was around looking at handing over some morning teaching. So we did morning teaching for the nurses in the hospital. And only when I went to the morning teaching and I, you know, did some conversations and some interviews and a survey, did I actually find out the real reasons why people weren't turning up to the training. And you only really do that by stopping and listening. So the look, listen, and feel method is how I mitigated some of those initial challenges.
I really agree with that around baseline setting, and until you've got a good baseline, you don't know where you're working from. So it is around that shared situation awareness and individual situation awareness about, you know, what level are people teaching at, what level are people practicing at. And so I think that piece, that active listening piece, is absolutely key. Could you maybe speak to how you built rapport with local staff, local nursing staff, and also just how you started to, I guess, in a way, get to know them on a personal and professional level?
I think building that rapport and building that trust is fundamental to doing any kind of leadership or change management. So because I was working with an NGO that was already present and had been present in the country for a while, I was, you know, building on the rapport of previous nurses and doctors and AHPs that I had worked with. So that's really good. So, you know, by having that lanyard, by saying I work, you know, with these different NGOs, those names are known. But people trusting an NGO and people trusting you are two different things. So what I did is I developed something called Creo Rounds. So Creo is the language that is spoken in Sierra Leone. It's like a pidgin English. And there's a few different dialects, but in Freetown, this is the dialect that's spoken the most. So when I got to the country, I realised that, you know, everybody was speaking Creo to each other. The patients were speaking Creo, the nurses and the staff and the doctors all speaking it. So I was like, right, okay, I need to get my head around this language. So I got a Creo teacher who was absolutely brilliant. His name was Bossaday. We had so much fun together and really, like, improved my time in Sierra Leone by knowing the language. So what I used to do as a way to kind of understand the system and get to know my new colleagues. So I would have my my Creo homework that Bossaday would set me, and you know, I would have certain words that I needed to find out. I'd have sort of like old proverbs in Creo that I needed to understand. And I went to the wards in the morning and I sat down at the nurse's station and I said, can you help me with my homework? And you know, I would learn, I would practice the different phrases, I would ask some questions about the different words that I needed to know. Everyone would laugh at me because my accent was terrible. But it was about understanding and getting to know people. And actually, through sitting at the nurse's station and watching and observing, once we kind of got to know each other, then I was able to ask the questions around like, oh, okay, so you know, how many students have you got on the ward, or what are people doing, or what does a shift look like? You know, did you go to the teaching in the morning? If not, why not? And it's about kind of like building that kind of those small steps to actually get to know people. And I think sometimes that can be quite difficult because it takes a long time. This kind of like building rapport, building trusting relationships takes a while. And I did have to hold my nerve a little bit because my Creo round method does take some time. And previously, I think people are so used to sort of like volunteers and international staff coming in and delivering training, looking at your KPIs. This is what I'm doing at the moment and I've got X amount of months to do it. But I took a slightly different approach. I went in, I was checking the pulse, but then I had people turn around to be like, what are you doing? You're not straight away delivering training. You're not doing all the usual things that we're used to seeing straight away. And so I did have to really hold my nerve because it was only until I could figure out what the real challenges were that I knew what to do. You know, the audits showed me that, you know, we had done loads of training on how to teach nurses how to take vital signs. We had loads of people coming to do the training, but on the wards, it wasn't transferring. So why are people not doing whatever we have taught? It's not because people don't know how to do it. It's not because people don't want to do it. It's because the system wasn't really supporting and allowing people to do that stuff. So until you kind of unpick some of that, you don't really know what to do. So it takes some time to build that rapport, but it's well worth doing.
So I completely agree with that. And I think from that basis, people are far more willing to listen, far more willing to engage, and far more willing to come alongside you and learn, which is powerful in a way, because like you said, it's about the longevity of intervention. And so it's not just the here and now. And Sierra Leone had just come out of probably one of the most torrid times in its history, the Ebola pandemic. Whilst you're building rapport, I'm sure lots of stories were coming out in the wash. I'm sure people had lots of stories to tell. Could you maybe speak to just maybe one or two of the stories that you heard from the staff and how it impacted staff on a local level?
I think context is so important here. When you're getting to know the organisation, the system, understanding the country and its history is really important whenever you're going in to do global health work. And so, you know, as I said, there was a 10-year civil war that ended in 2002. And then the Ebola crisis, 2014, 2015. And, you know, about 4,000 people died with that. Many, you know, healthcare workers caught Ebola and died of Ebola as well. So, you know, that's your healthcare leadership. Some of those key leaders unfortunately passed away. And that has such an effect on the healthcare system. It builds a lot of fear and worry in the system. And people were too scared to come to work. People, you know, might not have had the right PPE at the time or were working with what they had, especially early on in the Ebola crisis. And so there was a real worry about me putting myself forward and possibly taking this home to my family. And then also the stigma around hospital workers. Certain people were, you know, were pushed out of their households because they were a doctor and they were a nurse and they wanted to continue working in healthcare, and their families or their community said, well, then you can't come home now. So there was that fear that was around during that time. I would say one of the positives, if you can call it, you know, a positive that came up around it was, you know, having that experience with IPC, having that, like, you know, that rapid setup of different centres that different NGOs came in to support, that learning was taken through, and you could see that during COVID. So, you know, when COVID came about, IPC practices was like, right, okay, this is, we've met something similar to this. We've got an understanding of IPC practices, and some of those lessons were brought through into the COVID pandemic.
So looking at some of the emergent issues that became apparent over time, Anisa, within your appointment, because I think there is, you're right, and you said this earlier, there's the job on paper and there's the job you actually did. And looking at, you know, a diagnostic, so a baseline setting of actually what's needed and where people are at. Could you maybe speak to how some of these emergent issues became apparent over time, and maybe indeed how you tackled them?
Yeah. So I think often with these types of roles, you need to go in slightly open-minded to think, okay, the role is going to develop as you uncover, a bit of a, like a detective, you're uncovering different pieces of the puzzle, really. So I was initially going in to do some CPD work with the local hospital, and understanding actually the hospital as a whole. And how does that fit into the wider regional picture and then the national picture? So taking the education and training aspect, so why were people not coming to some of the training sessions? The answer wasn't just to put on more training, it was to find out why. So I did a survey. So as part of my career rounds in the end, I did, you know, went around with a box and some questionnaires to figure out why people aren't coming to training, or what some of the barriers were to coming to training. So some people were turning up late or missing training. And I think through that exploration, we kind of saw that there were some wider systems issues here. So for instance, the environment that you teach in. So I remember I was teaching one morning and I had a nurse faint because it was so hot. It was boiling in the room. So the actual place where you are in isn't conducive to learning. We had some of other answers came up that the style of training differed from day to day. Each morning, the education session was led by a different senior nurse. And each senior nurse had their own way of delivering things. And there were slightly different rules on each day, slightly different timings of when the training would start, when it would finish, and actually differences in the content. And sometimes there was actually contradictions in what was being taught. So one of the things that we were looking at, and I was very lucky, I was working with some really good national nurses that were working in the hospital that really got the education piece. So the senior matron of the hospital was really, really keen on education and leadership, and she was absolutely brilliant and in using her role modelling skills to support the work that I was doing, and was really involved in doing it side by side with me. I also had a brilliant training education nurse, a training coordinator, who'd been working with the NGO and the project for a few years, and we were developing and working with her so that she would go on to lead some of the education work. And she was absolutely brilliant as well. So I think a key thing is to work with those key people within the system and, you know, learn from them and understand what they can support you with and actually kind of see how you can support them to open different avenues on how you're going to tackle some of those bigger issues. For things like the environment, you know, that's actually quite an easy fix. So, you know, we painted the education room. It was right outside the matron's office. So we painted it, we put in aircon, so, you know, it was a good environment to be in. We put in new curtains, things like rewiring the plug. So the switch for the light switch was in a room that was often locked. So we just rewired where the plug was so that we could have lights and we could have aircon. We painted a mural on the wall. So, you know, I got a lot of the nurses together and I said, you know, what does nurse education mean for you? And we kind of came up with a word cloud and then got a local artist to come and paint those words on the wall so that people could come in and be like, that's my word. I said X, Y, and Z, you know, and that and people can really then own the space that they are in. They can be part of the piece that you are trying to support them to drive. So some of the things are like quick fixes, like, you know, infrastructure, painting things. Some of them are longer term stuff. So what came apparent is with the different leadership styles is that there might need to be like a cohesive understanding of like, what are joint rules for this morning teaching? And how are we going to standardize the message that we deliver? So I developed education in leadership training and then worked with the senior matrons to basically bring everybody on board for a shared vision so that the nurses on the wards, when they would come to training, they would see it was a united front about what we were trying to achieve.
So looking at that piece, actually, because I think what you're speaking to there is a piece around governance, and but there's this shared appreciation of what governance is. So governance is this panacea of training and education, clinical audit, review, but it's also about mitigating risk as well. But could you maybe speak to, so you've got this cohesive piece, everyone's starting to understand what the training is about, there's adoption, early adoption through rapport building. Could you maybe speak to how you approached clinical governance amongst the nursing cohorts and indeed how you embedded it?
So I think, again, with a bit of context here, so nurses in Sierra Leone, you work directly for the Ministry of Health. So you're not employed by the hospital or the trust, you're employed by Ministry of Health, and the ministry decide whereabouts your postings are to. So there isn't really a formal kind of structure for line management, which then makes accountability quite difficult, which then, you know, is the very sort of fundamental parts of a governance process and structure. So at times it can seem a bit unstructured. So some of the nurses across the country are volunteers, and so they're not getting paid. They're coming, they've got three or four different jobs. They are maybe coming to the hospital or using the clinic that they work in as a means so that they can do things like sell dressings, because that's how they get money to get food to provide for their families. So understanding the context that you are working with is so important. There is lots of things coming up around how governance is coming about in Sierra Leone, and specifically looking at the Directorate of Nursing and Midwifery. There's some really great and like big changes that are currently happening that were really exciting to be part of. So for instance, there's a new harmonised curriculum now. So the nursing schools in Sierra Leone will be taught the same harmonised curriculum, which is absolutely like a massive step, took loads and loads of work. And that's a really positive step. There's also now direct entry into midwifery. So beforehand you would do your nursing and then go into midwifery afterwards. And now there's direct entry. So there's things that are from the sort of like undergrad side that are starting to happen, looking at your pipeline of nurses, how we can standardize the information, the education, the training of the system. Now getting into slightly more of the governance part when you're qualified. So actually there's a bill that has just been passed through at the end of last year to turn the nursing board into a council. So the nursing council is now going to be set up and they will be governing themselves. And I think that's a huge step in the profession to have the Nursing and Midwifery Council have that overarching governance process, that accountability about how you formally set up and drive policies through an accountable council. So there is lots to do, but I think it's a really exciting, and there's some such great leaders happening, great leaders in the country that are really driving this change at the moment.
Anissa, could you speak to the human factors piece around sort of ascending levels of safety in task, system and individual, and how you approach that?
Yeah, so I think there's a real importance, and I think at this time it's quite good to talk about the role of leadership and role modelling. So as I said, some of these like great leaders and these nurses that I worked with who really understood the drive for safety in practice, education, standardisation and role modelling. So I think it's important to work with these people, with the leaders in the field, with the nurses on the wards who are doing this. You know, things like if you're looking at the safety piece from like from a ward level, having really clear escalation pathways. So we did a lot of work around, you know, so we called it the Sierra Leone Early Warning School, the SLUs. So we would have posters on all of the wards. So it was really clear. If you have a SLU score of 9, this is the escalation pathway. It's about having the teaching materials on the wall. So where we did the morning training, we had the standardized education kind of like voice, right? So when you have a septic patient, these are the steps that you take for them. It's about, you know, encouraging people to understand that you work as an MDT. You're not working as a sole practitioner on your own. How does your accountability fit into a team of people? How do you work with the doctors? How do you work with the physiotherapists? And how can you kind of document and use documentation to support that? So, you know, there's a step away from that kind of blame culture and a more of a understanding of like, okay, this is the formalized escalation pathway. This is what I did. This is who I've informed, and this is the evidence that I've got to do it. So there's something about driving that through and using everyday teaching to reinforce that and using your clinical leaders to role model that.
And something powerful about systems change is that, like you said, formalizing a process and embedding a process, but then seeing that process work. Like you said, simple things like putting education on flow diagrams on the wall so that actually there's a semblance of compliance. Yeah. Because you can't comply to something which might have 5 or 6 steps or 7 or 8 steps when there might be a complex patient in front of you, there's lots going on. So it's that human factors piece about having simple pieces of information, like a checklist, so you can embed compliance, and then you can go back and do a case review. How did you do it when we were running that ALS or situation, or how did that look to you? And then, so you can start to go back and measure that compliance against a checklist on a wall, or indeed an embodied checklist. But it's having the systems and processes which are simple, easy to understand, easy to comprehend, but then easy to enact. And I think that speaks to a culture of safety, actually, as well. And it kind of segues into how you sort of overcame some of the barriers to safety. Now, what I'd like to speak to, Anissa, if possible, is me and you have both worked in a developing context. And maybe could I get you to speak to, and I'm more than happy for you to ask me as well, around just people that are looking to get into development work. Just could you maybe give people an appreciation of how drastically different it can be to deliver clinical care on the ground in a developing context?
Yes, and it is, you know, as you said, like we've both done this, and I think the reality, I mean, you can read about different experiences, you can train to see, okay, when I don't have these resources, what can I do? But there's an element of when you are in the field and you're having to sort of pivot and kind of think, okay, what can I do and what is the safest way for me to do this? Not only safe for your patients, but you also need to think my own safety as a clinician. When you're working in contexts where there's a lack of, you know, sort of like some of that basic infrastructure. So some of the hospitals that I visited and worked within in Sierra Leone, there might not be constant running water. There might not be constant electricity. So it's thinking about, okay, how can I do the best that I can do in this situation? So there's no running water. Okay. So let's get, you know, they call them the, you know, the big Veronica buckets, the big buckets of water and that I've got a little tap on and you go, right, okay, I do have access to a bucket of water and some soap. So that's going to be my, you know, making sure that I can do my hand washing in this area is really important. And I think there's an element of, you know, going back to basics, looking at your ABCDE and not forgetting that part of things that you learn maybe early on in your training to go, okay, how do I assess things when it's just me? I think we are so used to using machines, and I think loads of NGOs bring in, okay, here is a SATS probe, here is a new machine to do this, here is a blood pressure cuff. But when these things fail, so you might not have the, you know, the clinical engineering departments to fix it, or there might be parts of the machine that do not are broken, or they just don't withstand. And you know, Sierra Leone is boiling hot. Like, you know, some of these things, the wear and tear is even hotter, even dustier, even wetter when it's rainy season. Like, there's things that happen that you're like, I've never seen this before. And so I think it's important to go back to basics. How do you know that your patient's oxygen saturations are low? You know, you don't just, you know, back before a SATS probe, how would you do that? You know, what do you do when you don't have the kit? How do you do a chest assessment if you don't have a stethoscope? You know, you put your hands on your patient. You feel, what can you feel when you are percussing? What can you feel like? Is it equal chest movement? Is there equal expansion? And it's things like that, that kind of like you need to go back to, you need to think, okay, what are the basics and am I doing the basics right? Because you might not be able to do the big things. And I think that can sometimes be a bit jarring and you can feel a little bit stressed out by, oh, if I had this kit, if I had this, that, I'd be able to do X, Y, and Z. The reality is you don't, but you've got a wealth of experience. And so it's drawing on what you already know you can do without all the kit, really. I don't know, like you have seen this in a different context in different countries. So I don't know if you have seen similar things.
Yeah, really interesting. You said a lot of good stuff there, Anissa, and absolutely resonate with that. So the reliance on diagnostics can be a rate limiting step, actually, when you actually need to, like you say, bring it back to basics, understand what is sensitive, and either, you know, your inspection and your palpation. And working off that basis when you haven't got a iSNAP machine, so you haven't got blood gases, you haven't got a CT scanner, you haven't got an X-ray machine, you might not have ultrasound. But coming back to basics, looking at palpation of pulses, at skin turgor, at diaphoresis, at the basics of blood pressures over time, and learning to profile risk and appreciate risk in a different way, bringing other people into the decision making and looking at how you make decisions on that basis. And actually, it's really healthy for clinical gestalt. It's really healthy to come back to basics, to get an appreciation of the patient's baseline and indeed of the way you make decisions.
Definitely. And I think you've reminded me something there about I think people think if you're going out to do this kind of international development work that you have, right, I've got the solutions, and people might, you know, kind of say, oh, what would you do? Actually, I learned so much working in that context and being like, okay, so how do you guys do things? What is the norm over here? How do you see things? How do you treat this? Even if it's, you know, so for instance, I think we're so used to seeing X-rays on computer screens. Like, I haven't seen an X-ray in film in many, many years. And it's a lot harder to interpret an X-ray when it's on film using light boxes. It's been some time. So, you know, like some of the things I was like, oh, okay, I'm going to ask other people. I'm not just going to go ahead and be like, okay, it's been a while since I've done this. I'm going to ask the clinicians who are brilliant in their field, worked in Sierra Leone their whole life, and be like, okay, can we review this together? I think there's a really importance to be like, you don't have all of the answers. And looking at the wider systems piece, I think when you're going out into do development work and humanitarian work, the solutions do not exist externally. They exist in the system. And actually, like, my role wasn't to come up with the answers. My role was to be that conduit to say, okay, I'm going to provide you with a little bit of space to think about that. I'm going to bring you out and ask you the questions and give you time to kind of unpick and brainstorm how we could come at a solution, come at a problem from a different angle. You know, it's kind of like creating a framework for other people to hang their ideas on. And it's about empowering people to say, you know what, you have the answers. You've worked here way longer than I have. I've been here a year. You've been here your whole life working in this health system. So you are brilliant and you have lived experience in this. And actually bringing people on as equals, bringing people on as leaders, and actually going, okay, let's look at this together. What's your experience? And supporting people and empowering people is a really important part of change management. Because after a year, I left. But the people I was working with will still continue on working. And there will be that other external support coming from different NGOs. And it's thinking about, okay, how can we all work together? But you are the constant here. So how can I empower you to be the leader when I go? And I think that's a really important part when working in this field.
Something powerful you said earlier, Anisa, is about this active listening piece and appreciation of baseline to then look to see where the gaps are. But the missing piece of the puzzle is what you just said there, is that the answers are within the system. It's how you match the answers within the system to the issues. And part of that was the clinical training. Part of that was the leadership piece and the leadership training you were doing. And so people listening to this, and you get questions all the time, and I get questions a lot around how you get into this development work. And part of hopefully what I hope people are taking from this is it's not just about embedding clinical practice or governance or indeed safe systems of working. There's a real piece around non-technical skills and about leadership training here and about fostering what's already existing in the staff and calling it out of them, calling, you know, these leadership, these fellowship, these non-technical skills out of staff so that they can embody them in through the passage of time. I wonder, could you speak to just take home messages regarding anyone who's thinking of coming into this training, into the INGO world, what you would advise, indeed maybe even how you got into it yourself, and some of these missing pieces of the puzzle which you've just mentioned in the past hour?
So I mean, I'd say do it. It's great. So I think I knew I wanted to go into global health for a while. I actually, like, very early on in my career, I was like, I really want to do sort of like disaster relief nursing. And for lots of different reasons, I kind of fell into that very kind of like NHS, almost kind of like linear way of working. You're band 5, you're band 6, you're band 7, you're band 8, and then you end up kind of in this role. And you kind of go, oh, okay, there were different avenues somewhere along the line. Actually, thinking about it now, the work I was able to do and the work I was able to support around systems development, I wouldn't really have been able to do in the same way if I did when I was more junior in my career. And not to say that there isn't a space for that. I think there's development work and there's humanitarian work, and they need to work side by side. But they are two different beasts. One, you know, there was a mudslide in Sierra Leone. There was response to that. There was a fuel tanker explosion. There was immediate response for burns training, which is so important to have that on the ground work. And then you kind of get that development piece, which is the systems development, which is slow, which is painful at times, which doesn't have that quick fix element that I think sometimes we're quite used to as clinicians, especially if you've kind of doing that humanitarian stuff. You're used to seeing that instant feedback of like, okay, this is a situation and I've gone in to contain some of this, you know, this chaos in this moment following a disaster. Now, the development side of stuff is slower, but it is so important, and the two need to happen in tandem. So I would say people that want to go into it, I don't think there is like a right time to do it in your career. I don't think you should do it when you are, you know, very, very senior or when you are very, very junior. I think your part in the system is equally as important, but don't think you can only do it when you are fully clinical facing, is what I would say. A lot of the important stuff is around sustaining systems development, change management, and that actually happens when you're later on and you've got more experience doing some of that wider leadership roles. So one of the things I would say is, yeah, so there isn't a right or a wrong time to do it. You could do it at any time in your career and you'll have transferable skills. The one thing I would say is, you know, be open, because it is difficult. It doesn't come without its ups and downs. It's a little bit, I kind of liken it to a game of snakes and ladders. So like you're thinking, yeah, this is absolutely brilliant. Then something happens and you're like, oh my God, I've fallen down is it the snake or the ladder? Which one do you fall down?
I think you fall down the snakes. I think you climb the ladder. Fall down the snakes.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. It's like that. And in Sierra Leone, there's pretty big snakes as well, so that totally works. So you might fall down the snake and be like, oh my goodness, I'm so much far behind. But it's that kind of like roller coaster that, you know, it is hard. So I would say it's really important to do something you believe in, something that matches your values. So if you're thinking about to go and work on a project, is it something that you have that passion for? Because there are going to be moments, there's going to be dark times where you're going to need to draw on your passion for it. You're going to need to really dig deep to realize, what do I believe in and what's helping me get forward? So that's something. And I think really immersing yourself in the country, be curious, ask questions. You know, you're not going to change the whole system. So I was only in Sierra Leone for a year. That's not a long time at all. Some of the things that I helped to embed are still going and I'm still in contact. You know, I've got WhatsApp groups with the senior nurse leaders that I'm still part of. And, you know, we do chat. Some of those things are still happening. Some of those things aren't. And that's okay as well. You know, you're not going to change everything. And I think so there were two phrases, my first two phrases that I learned in Creo, kind of pretty much really kind of set the scene for me when I was in Salone. So like the first phrase I learned was small, small. And everybody in Salone, they go, you know, you go small, small. And that kind of means like you put one foot in front of the other, take one step at a time. It's okay to go a little bit slower. And you know, just, you know, you'll get there. And it's like, go small, small, that's fine. And the second phrase I learnt was kalu kalu, which basically means banter, means have a bit of a laugh. And I think that's equally as important. A, I think that sums up the culture in the country of like such lovely, warm, funny people. And, you know, but understanding that you need to enjoy it. You need to understand that sometimes, you know what, when you are living, you're going to go home. You're not going to have an electricity. You're not going to have any water. You know, everything in your fridge might go off because you've not had electricity all day. And that happens. And you might need to wash your hair in a gutter in the rain. That did happen. These things happen. You need to have a bit of a laugh with it and just kind of go with the flow a little bit. Because you need to take that time to take a step back and to feel it. Because it's not always easy, but there's a load of fun that you can have in between. You know, somewhere like Sierra Leone, you have the most beautiful beaches. You can get lost just like staring at the ocean there. And I think one of the really important things that I really wanted to talk about was around how you look after your own mental health when you are working in developing countries, or you are seeing things that you know you're not used to seeing. I think it's really important to find ways and think of methods that you can have that downtime, come back to center, realize, okay, that was a really difficult shift, or that, you know, some of those processes were very, very frustrating. How do you deal with that? Are you, you know, whether it's exercise or, you know, going out with friends or having a dance and putting on really loud music, like, you know, whatever it is, figure out what your mechanisms are for to kind of preserve your own health, your own mental health, your own physical health in those environments, because it can be really difficult. And I think, you know, I had a mentor once that said to me, you know, just because you can do something, Anissa, doesn't mean you should. And I think as people that kind of are drawn to working in these developing sectors, humanitarian work, we're kind of used to being like human doings instead of being human beings. And we think that if we stand still for too long, we might rust. But it's understanding that actually it's important to stand still and take that time. And I think one of the really, really great things is get yourself a good mentor and a good coach. Like, I've been very lucky in my whole career, actually, in that you don't just wait till you're in a senior position or in a difficult role to get a mentor. I've had really good mentors in my career that have really supported and helped me. And actually, when I was in Sierra Leone, I had a coach. And she was an absolutely brilliant nurse, loads of experience in global health. And meeting with her, and it was all on Zoom because she was in the UK, kind of having that person to help kind of problem solve with, who's got more experience in that field, but then also having somebody to say things to, like, oh my God, that was really difficult. Or, you know, when I was getting that feedback from some of the nurses, which was like, Anissa, you're not delivering training. And I was going home thinking, oh my God, everyone hates me. Like, kind of speak to my coach, and she was able to kind of hold that space with me and for me and kind of remind me of the bigger picture. That's invaluable. And that's so important to have that, like, that heat and light in what you are doing. You need to have enough heat to keep you agitated to move forward, but you need to have enough light that you are have that blue sky thinking, you have that nourishment, you have that growth space, and having mentors and coaches to support that is absolutely invaluable. So I would definitely say that's a key point.
Anissa, that's fantastic. And I just agree with everything you just said there. And I just think from that learning piece is so powerful from a mentorship perspective. And I actually don't think we ever lose that. I think you yourself have said in the past, you know, commit to lifelong learning. And actually having mentors in different areas and different phases of life is absolutely key for very different reasons. But Anissa, listen, thank you for that. Last hour, it's been absolutely fascinating talking to you, and just unpicking some of the fundamentals of your recent deployment. So thank you for that. I think what we'll do in the show notes is we'll put your LinkedIn profile, just so if anything resonates to people, they can reach out to you on LinkedIn and just ask further questions.
Of course.
That'd be fantastic. Thank you again.
Well, thank you so much. It's been great to chat over things.
You're listening to the Pre-Hospital Care podcast on the Medics Academy Network.